I feel like, you know, what's happened here is much clearer and over a larger area than what has happened in Yellowstone. So I see no reason why, you know, Willeen couldn't become the new sort of Wolves in Yellowstone. Anyway, that's my dream.
G'day, Anthony James here for the regeneration from Irrumuggadoo, Roeburn. In fact, up the hill at the lookout with the extraordinary public art installations here denoting the different countries around here, I'm at the foot of Injibandy Man. This place is about 600 kilometres from Exmouth and 40 kilometres north of the incredible Murujuga. The latter was featured in episode 109 and will be again soon in a couple of conversations I've had here over the last couple of days. More on that later. For now, the voice you heard at the top was David Pollock at Wooleen Station. This was our first stop out of Perth as we headed north, and our first visit there in 3 years. And again, uncannily, its release comes after Wooleen and Yellowstone were both spoken about in last week's episode with Montanan stars Nicole Masters and Megan Lannan. If that episode might have been called Armoured Butts, this one might be called The Dingo Strikes Back. If you've heard episode 164, you'll be with me on this. More pointedly, when it comes to shifting the sense of what's possible, Wooleen is taking this to new levels as the regeneration of country, community and culture continues to generate its own momentum out here now. A number of long-held visions are currently coming to fruition, including with 24-year-old Zali Jastrzymski.
You can strip right back to what's really important when you're out in the bush. And I think personally, I could go on to a whole nother avenue here and talk about... personally, I didn't grow up in a religious household, and I never really learnt much about, you know, even choosing a religion or what religion I'd go by. And for me, it's always kind of just been that nature makes sense.
Zali's from Sunbury, Victoria, a town famous for a concert in the 70s that became known as Australia's Woodstock. Though I got to know it as the town of my first girlfriend, but that's another story. Zali's now at the helm of a new dingo education centre at Wooleen and some potentially game-changing research. What if it can be shown that the dingoes of the Murchison region here are having an even greater regenerative impact than the famed wolves of Yellowstone? Before we start, great thanks this week to Chris Dowling for continuing your support with a monthly donation, and huge, huge thanks to Sven, Kylie and the team at Impact Seed for donating 3 years' worth of your generous support. What a vote of confidence for this ad-free, listener-supported podcast. If you're also finding value in this, please consider letting me know by joining Chris and the Impact Seed team, part of a great community of supporting listeners, with as little as $3 a month or whatever amount you can and want to contribute. You can enjoy a variety of benefits and, of course, continue to receive the podcast every week. Just head to the website via the show notes, regeneration.com/support. And thanks again. Okay, let's take a seat outside the homestead at Wooleen with Zali and Dave.
That's Bowbird. A Bowbird.
Yeah. Is that the Bowbird?
Yeah, he'll probably keep going.
Well, Bowbird gets a Guernsey for that. We'll keep him in. And there he is. And it's... I think they might have even stopped the machinery for a moment. But the machinery that we'll be hearing is the new cafe reception area.
Indeed.
Which has been, a dream as long as I've known you, and then some, I imagine, to bring the old heritage kitchen from whatever it was. What was it?
Seven Ks, yeah.
There you go. And to bring it over here and set it up. So let's reference that to start with, given people might hear the tractors out front of the homestead here. What the plan is, what the vision's been for all this time, and what's actually coming to fruition, and then we'll talk about how the dingo education program.
Well, the dream wasn't mine for a long time. It was more of a nightmare of mine. not so much a nightmare. I just thought it would never happen. But it was definitely a dream of Frances's, and she was like, "This is going to be the most amazing thing." And I'm like, We're pastoralists. We don't move buildings, especially ones with stone, massive stone chimneys. Like, this is just never going to happen. I mean, it's nice that you have this vision, but yeah. So, and it's happening, you know. We've pretty much done it. The stonemason's turned up. He was the last major, you know, thing to make sure that we'd got to make it happen.
And well, so that was today?
Yeah, so he's turned up today. So he's over there crushing rocks and whatnot. So we've got this incredible building. So it was built by Afkouch, and so he built these rolled roofs, which Willeen was already known for. And Willeen Homestead was already the main conglomeration of Afkouch buildings. But now we've got this kitchen. He only built two T-intersection barrel vault roofs, and this is the last one sort of standing. And incredibly difficult to build. No one else built anything like it. So
it's incredible.
So now it's up the house. It's going to be our reception and a bit of a cafe and a place where other people can come and, you know, present their passions, really.
Because
there's a bunch of people that, you know, wanted to work with us over the years for different things, which are very in line with what, you know what we want to promote. But we haven't really had a space for it, and this, you know, the kitchen is the old kitchen is perfect for that. So
incredible. So yeah. What's the lesson? The power of a vision.
What is the lesson?
Listen to your wife.
Just assume she's going to get away. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. And perfect. Proceed on that basis. Very good. And wisely
she knows.
No, it looks amazing. It's just incredible. It'll be up soon, right? It'll be going before long, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. Like so
June?
June. That seems like it's not very far away.
Mm.
We're going to get it sort of going as soon as possible. We're waiting on a kitchen. But, I mean, that will happen soon enough. Francis's brother was also the builder. So, and, you know, put a massive amount of time and, you know, energy into the, you know, real nitty gritty specifics. He's a bit of a perfectionist from the Jones Carpentry Company. If you're over east, it's well worth looking up if you want to do something out of the box. I forgot what the question was.
Just that it's starting soon.
Yeah, yeah.
You've answered
it's starting soon. So yes. The bowerbird's pretending to be a cat. There it is.
Wow. It's still the bowerbird.
I think it's like
amazing.
I think that a cat is the scariest thing the bowerbird can think of. So when it's like there's people in its space, it's like, well, I'm a cat. Go away.
Wow. It's amazing. And it segues to you, Zali, too, in the sense of being a place where other people can come in that relate to this exercise and enterprise and project in some way. But of course, you didn't need to wait for it. You've been here for a bit over a year already, and the Dingo Education Space is getting up and running. You were just showing us this little enclosure at the back. Perhaps take the listener in there where we've just been.
Yeah, okay. So we took yourself and Olivia and Yeshi in to meet our two resident dingoes that we have here. We're very lucky to have one dingo in particular who is very confident around strangers, and I think he greeted you guys pretty nicely.
Beautifully.
He's very happy to meet new people, which is fantastic.
Which by the way, it was incredible to really be in that connection, in relationship with dingo.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Like an amazing animal, to that particular one, to be so disposed to our company.
And I think it's so interesting how a lot of their features, and just in general how they look, they do look very much like a domestic dog if you don't know what to look out for.
Mm.
But I found the same with when I met my first dingoes, you know, or touched my first dingo, that there's something that feels different. And I suppose that is because they are, you know, a wild animal or they're wildlife, but there's something about them that actually just feels different, even if you don't know any differences between dingoes and dogs. So I think that's quite special to share with other people.
Yeah, yeah. And to set it up here, well, let's start with how you came to be at Willeen. Where did that connection arise?
So I knew about Willeen for quite a long time, for a few years. And I was travelling Australia, and being from Melbourne originally, Willeen's a very long way away from where I'm from. I was travelling Australia and I couldn't wait to get to Willeen. But when I was in WA, I worked up in Derby, up at north for a little while. And
you're in Derby?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's where we've been based, and we'll be going straight up to after this.
Good to head up there. Wow. Yeah. So quite like that, we stuck around and ended up getting jobs there and enjoyed that for a while. And so by the time we were coming down the coast towards Perth, it was summer, and Wooleen Station, like a lot of the stations around here, are closed at that time because it's, you know, summer and 45 degrees and you don't want to be out here camping anyway. So by the time I got to Perth, I was quite sad to have missed Wooleen, but knew that I'd make it up here eventually anyway because it was so high on my list. And then Frances posted a job ad when I got to Perth, and I applied for it, and I think within 5 minutes I pretty much had the job, which was so exciting.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. And so this was a bit over a year ago.
Yeah, this was March last year that I arrived here for the first time. Yeah.
And you knew it before, you knew of Wooleen, obviously. You were coming over to visit in the first instance anyway.
Yeah.
So how did it come across your radar?
So my background is in wildlife conservation, and that is where my interest sparked with dingoes in general, being an apex predator. But the question that wasn't answered for me much was, if dingoes are so beneficial for the landscape, then why aren't more people retaining dingoes? And in my avenue of looking for answers to that question, I came across Wooleen, a few years ago. And, you know, Frances and Dave are publicly pro-dingo, which is a very controversial and rare thing across Australia. So even though there's lots of stations that do choose to retain dingoes, there's not many that openly talk about it. So it was pretty awesome to see that people are not only retaining them, but also talking about it as well. And so that's how I first learnt about Wooleen.
And where did this start for you, like particularly the dingo amongst your interest in broader wildlife conservation?
So as I said, I was doing my wildlife conservation undergrad degree, and I just went to the dingo sanctuary because it was close to home and didn't know much about dingoes.
Where is it?
In Gisborne, right. Or in Tulwood Vale, actually. Gisborne's the closest town, so just an hour out of Melbourne. And so I went to the sanctuary, and before you're allowed to meet any dingoes, you have to sit through a presentation or a talk first. And within that presentation, they talk about the differences between dingoes and dogs, but also why they're so important in our landscapes and what their role is as an apex predator. And I left being confused and maybe even a little bit angry, thinking, if what these people are saying is correct, then why haven't I learnt much about it in my degree, or why is nobody talking about this?
Yes.
And why are they treated so differently to other apex predators across the world? And I guess the answer to that is, Australia's just behind the game when it comes to dealing with predators, especially on private land. So I was very, very interested in that, and I went back to, the subjects at uni. They sort of said, we do know that dingoes have this important role, but the research is just emerging now, because the initial research on dingoes was more about how to better protect sheep or how to better control or kill dingoes, rather than actually what a dingo is and what is their place in the environment. But that was probably 5-6 years ago now, and there's quite a lot published about their role, and so I went and kind of did a deep dive in research there and did my own research project in my undergrad and published a paper on dingoes in Victoria, and yeah, just kind of got hooked. I started volunteering and never left, basically, six years ago. Yeah.
So is it true to say that in that period of time, the broader body of research is coming through now?
Yeah, it feels like change is certainly happening. Mm. The founder of the Australian Dingo Foundation, she's incredible. She's 81 now, and she's been working with dingoes for over 40 years. And, you know, when she first got dingoes, the research just really wasn't there. It was really lacking. The way that she runs dingoes and, everything that she's doing has changed so much over the years, because we just didn't have the science there in the beginning. And a lot of the science that's emerging, you know, is thanks to people like Lynn Watson, is her name, because she decided that something had to be done and that nothing was being done. And she just sort of started these processes where we do have, you know, non-invasive research happening at the sanctuary, thanks to her, and all these other things, things that start progressing. And even since I've been involved in the conversation, it feels like on social media, the posts that I would see about dingoes were all pretty much negative if you looked at the comments section. Whereas now, if you look at comments section on posts about dingoes, at least half are generally saying, you know, the dingo is important, or, you know, something that's a lot more positive or not just a one-sided debate anymore.
There you go. All right. Do you want to keep going then? Steer us into some of the stuff that, I guess, opened your eyes and that is, I guess, so, I mean, it's everything Dave's been talking about on on this place for a while as well, but everything that you learnt that really opened your eyes about the dingo in this landscape?
Yeah, as in here at Wooleen in particular, or
in general? Yeah, for you, where the lights really came on. And
yeah, so growing up, I knew nothing about dingoes and never thought anything of them. You know, in fact, I think I saw a dingo at Uluru with my family when I was 10, and we would have just said, oh, it's a wild dog, you know, like we really didn't think anything of them. And there's this big assumption or myth in Victoria especially that there's no pure dingoes left at all, like dingoes are just never mentioned. And so not only was I learning what a dingo is and why they're so beneficial to our landscapes, but also learning that when I was camping and saw, you know, these animals in the wild, they were very likely dingoes, or they were dingoes, which I never would have thought at the time. And so it just really opens up this whole new sphere of looking at our apex predator, of going, you know, we are actually still living alongside them, and they are around, and they are performing this role. And I really just couldn't believe, yeah, how much I didn't know about them.
Yeah.
Seem to know more about, like, lions or wolves, you know, than you do about our own apex predators.
Totally. Yep. Yeah. Because you guys were saying before, there are no feral dogs.
That's right.
Period.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
you're so, looking at a dingo if you're seeing a dog, you know, a dog-looking creature, yeah, if I can say that. But you're basically looking at a dingo.
If it's in the wild,
that's it. Yeah. So feral domestic dogs are not an established pest in Australia. And what that means is there isn't a situation recorded where you've got one domestic dog breeding with another domestic dog, raising puppies that survive to breeding age without the assistance of humans in the wild. So we're not talking about stray dogs, of course. So that just means that they can't, you know, replenish their own population in the wild. So that hasn't been recorded, which means that they're not an established pest. So that doesn't mean that, you know, one dog isn't going to go out there and survive in the wild without humans, maybe catch some rabbits and things like that. But what they can't do is successfully raise a litter of domestic dog puppies that will survive. And essentially, if a domestic dog is going to roam around in the bush and find someone else to mate with, you know, who is it they're going to run into to mate with?
The dingo?
The dingo, that's right, yeah. And so if they have puppies, you know, that survive to breeding age, in which case, you know, they have to be probably quite dominant dingo to even survive, who are the puppies then going to run into to breed with next? Yeah. Another dingo?
Yeah.
That's right. So already very quickly you have 75% dingo.
Yes.
And we just call them dingoes because, you know, they look like a dingo, they can survive in the wild without humans, they're going to be behaving like a dingo, which means they'll be, you know, territorial, they'll have strict social structures and all these things that make dingoes dingoes. So essentially that just means that you either have pure dingoes or high content dingoes, and, you know, they're all dingoes.
It's, the irony hits me like it actually never has before, just hearing it, hearing us talk about this. The fact that there's feral dogs aren't, what did you say? They're not a designated pest.
Yeah, they're not an established pest.
Not an established pest.
So you can have one here and there, you know, roaming around. Yes. But yeah, they won't have,
it won't take
they
hold.
Won't replenish their own populations in the wild. Yeah.
So there's that. Yet, in the killing of all the dingoes, the talk and the sort of logic is that they're feral dogs that have taken hold.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
But even in conventional terms and official terms, that doesn't happen. So it's like the layers of irony in this sort of grow the more you get to understand.
Yeah, that's right. And so the term wild dog is the term that's always thrown around to control dingoes in the wild. And most people, when they hear the term wild dog, they just think, oh, it's a feral dog, it's an introduced animal, you know, great job that you're controlling them. But, you know, in actual fact, they're talking about dingoes, which most people quite like dingoes, and they know that dingoes have a role here in the environment, and they don't want dingoes to be persecuted. And what's quite interesting as well is a lot of people don't know a lot of differences between dingoes and domestic dogs. A lot of people generally rely on colour, but dingoes can come in a whole range of different colours, including black and tan and white and even brindle and sable as well. And so if they're going off colour, you know, that's one thing. They think that anything that's not tan is a dog that's gone wild, which is just not usually the case. Yeah, but we do know from DNA testing as well that they are all dingoes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Dave, I wonder what your journey's been like parallel to Zali's before you come together here in terms of shifting experiences on the ground here as someone who, yeah, raised your head above the pulpit, formed landholders for dingoes, I think, as well.
Yeah, yep.
Have you sensed a change in the air as well, or are you still feeling like on the ground out at a station like this, it could still be, you know, 20 years ago or more in terms of your isolation?
There's definitely been a huge change, and the change is, you know, the dingoes have brought about that change. You know, they've wiped all the goats out of this area, all the foxes, and sort of 90% of the kangaroos. So that's a pretty hard thing for
which were in plague proportion, the reason.
Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, together the goats and kangaroos sort of represented about 60% of the grazing pressure previously. So, you know, that's, you can't really not notice that. And then, you know, the effects of the landscape on the landscape have been, you know, tremendously positive. So that's come to most pastoralists' attention, though some are so steeped in the culture that the dingo is the enemy that they just, they refuse to pay any heed to that. You know, it's amazing the power of culture. And I think the, you know, the wild dogs thing just plays into that so well. And it's essentially, you know, wild dogs is the name that we've given dingoes so we can kill, we can still kill them with a clean conscience.
Yeah.
You know? Like, and you know,
and no public uproar.
Yeah, and without the public having any idea. So, yeah, it's been a pretty amazing, had a pretty amazing effect on the landscape. And I think most pastoralists, well, maybe not most pastoralists, but a lot of pastoralists, you know, the thinking pastoralists, the ones that know what their pasture is, I guess, and pay a close attention to their pasture, can't help but notice that that we've got our dog back.
That's a dog, huffing, not a dingo.
Huffing at us in the background.
Particularly me.
We're not throwing the stick. He's deaf too, so I can't tell it to go away.
It's like he doesn't have a mic on. Yes, I do. You just can't see it. It's all hidden. I've got a mic on. I can't talk to you right now. A gorgeous face.
Get out, get out. I need to throw something at him.
Unreal. And yeah, going, just to emphasise the what you've obviously advocated for a long time too. Is it true to say if we ignore
ignore the dog?
Ignore the
can
dog.
You, like, she's just looking. She's looking at Anthony. She doesn't care what anybody else is. She's like,
oh,
Anthony,
my God.
Throw the stick. Don't throw the stick. You'll start stumbling. She'll...
Later.
That's not going to work.
That's not going to work? What's going to work?
So if I can somehow communicate she's not wanted.
Let's see how we go. Yeah. We'll proceed. And the applicability and importance of what you're doing here is like being in a semi-arid to arid landscape... Oh. And this is the large part of the Australian landmass and certainly pastoral territory. But landmass as a whole, I think, is some extraordinary high percentage, isn't it?
Yep.
I mean, like almost 40% or something. Is that right?
We'll go with that. I'm not for sure.
Yeah. I think from memory, it's right up there. And so to think that the relevance of what you're doing here matters that much, and not only obviously in terms of this country, but around the world, with relevant apex predators that obviously we've heard of the wolves in the States and others elsewhere. To think that, I mean, as a semi-outsider, right, it blows my mind to think of the fact that there's this animal that will do this for us in that respect, that we are hell-bent at continuing to wipe out.
But that's the thing, and that's the insidious nature of the term wild dog. Because if we just say, hang on a second, let's have a look at the DNA evidence, you know, the vast majority of these animals are pure dingo, and the few that are not pure are really high percentage dingo, and with, as Ali says, you know, with further breeding, you know, can only become more dingo. Like, if you take the term wild dog out of it, like, people are already on the side. The sheep producers, are not going to like the dingoes either, because whether they're wild dogs or dingoes, you know, because they're going to eat their sheep. But, you know, outside of the small stock industry, most people are already on side with it. So it's like the battle's almost won, but for this term,
wow,
wild dog. It's Yeah.
So the language and the story in that sense really matters.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it always does, but in here, all the more.
Yeah. And one of the most interesting things is, and I suppose that's removed from, you know, we're talking about pastoralism and farming, in national parks is such a great example, because a lot of people in national parks, of course, respect the role of a dingo more than anywhere else. However, wild dog control happens in pretty much all of our national parks. So I think that kind of goes to show how much the term, you know, can impact how we are controlling dingoes or even pest animals in general. If you have the term there, it just gets relied upon that you're controlling wild dogs, and, you know, it seems that it's a good thing, but in actual fact, you're killing dingoes.
That's an interesting thing, though. So that there are multiple fronts that we can come at this change in language then.
Yeah,
if it's being used in different domains, yeah, we're not just relying on baiting pastoralists. There's different agencies even that are still employing it. And in contradiction, like in that case, in contradiction.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. It's pretty wide-ranging.
Yes, which is you know, hard in a way, but it also says there's opportunity everywhere you look, wherever you want to intervene.
And I think it's probably also important to note that some people aren't going to care whether they're wild dogs or dingoes. You know, if they're threatening your livestock or your sheep in particular, it doesn't matter what they're called. You know, you don't want them around, sort of thing. But in most of our land, I think across Australia, it'd be very beneficial to just be calling them dingoes instead of wild dogs, because it is where it matters, in national parks, but also for cattle producers. And, you know, in Victoria, for example, dingoes are actually classified as a threatened protected species. However, wild dog control happens all through the state. So,
yeah, interesting.
So, yeah, it's really important there to get the terminology correct.
Oh, so interesting, Zali. Yeah, so... So in terms of the story being told, you did actually set up a YouTube channel, the Dingo channel. Do you even want me to say this?
Not particularly, no.
Early experiments, though, that are relevant.
Yeah, I've created a few videos, especially during lockdown, that had sections of like a presentation I would normally give about dingoes at the Australian Dingo Foundation. I think partially I've grown a bit as a person since making those videos, and I think some of the... Yeah, the way that I presented then, I suppose I wouldn't anymore. I guess that's everyone, though. Like, you grow and change and...
Tell me.
It's all... you develop...
You should have seen Anthony when he started out.
No, you should have. I will admit that I went back to episodes 1 and 2 and redid them.
Yeah.
Like, obviously,
yeah,
I didn't.
Well, that's what I want to do.
Yes, I know. I just thought, really, I'll draw the line there, but I'm changing those two for sure.
Yeah, that's it. And, like, we were just talking about, the video that we did recently, David and myself, about the dead dingo that was found here, and how, even though I really wanted to put it aside and maybe either not make videos anymore or delete them and make some again, you know, how I'd like them now, that just seemed too important not to upload or talk about sort of straight away. So then I have uploaded that one more recently, but... Other than that, no, I'm not really wanting to talk about the channel, I suppose.
I tell you, that as I said before off air as well, that was an extraordinary piece of work, though. That's, that's well worth a watch. As tough as it is to watch, that is well worth a watch. And I'm glad you did it. But it does go to show, and I guess you've got half an eye on that public-facing thing, right? And the different ways that you might be able to do it. And so here is obviously another way at Wooleen Station right now.
Yeah.
So you've set up this centre. So how did, I guess there's two threads to this, right? You've come in and you're doing a whole bunch of stuff on the station, but it's now become this dingo education program as well.
Mm.
And you're looking to continue your academic research on it here at the same time. So how are these two things going to come together?
Yeah, that's it. So I've been giving presentations through the Australian Dingo Foundation for the past 5 or 6 years. And so at the sanctuary, when I was there, we would take dingoes out to schools or community events quite frequently and give presentations. So that's where I started actually sort of giving dingo talks. And then as I travelled Australia, I gave some talks as well at like land care groups and other places. And I said to Frances near to when I first got here, would you like me to give some dingo talks? Because I'd love to. And she said, yes, I was going to ask you if you could do that.
Great.
And so pretty quickly we started establishing the dingo talks. So I have been giving them here at Wooleen for a year now. And the actual having the dingoes here is the new addition as of this year. So they've only been here for a couple of months. And that's fantastic because that sort of ties in with, sorry.
No, go on.
That's fantastic because that sort of ties in with, you know, the tourism and hospitality that's done here, and the education is so important about dingoes. You know, we're talking about the term wild dog being misleading and things like that. The ways to get around that, you know, one of the biggest ways is education. So it's great that I have a sort of hub here to continue that on. And we've got the two resident dingoes here now, which is fantastic because I can introduce people to dingoes. Like I said before, there's something really special about when you actually meet a dingo to understand how different they are.
Especially Stephen.
Yes, especially
Stephen.
This
is true. Yeah. And yeah. Just on that though,
yeah.
How did the machinations work? How did they come to be here?
Dave?
So they came from the Australian Dingo Foundation over in where Zali was working in Victoria, and so they had a couple that were lined up for the Adelaide Zoo, and that sort of fell apart. And then they said, you know, because Zali was over here, and you know, it's no small undertaking taking on a couple of dingoes. I know people that have tried to just like they've found cubs out in the wild and then they've tried to raise them, and very quickly you don't hear any more about it, and now I know why. Like, they're not an easy animal to keep. So anyway, build big pens to keep them in and things to keep them occupied, and you know, establish routines and things. But anyway, we went over to Victoria. Well, you'd spent a lot of time with them, so that they were used to you, because you have to really introduce them to things and people really slowly. So Dali'd been over there for a month, and they were getting used to her, and you know, really, and that's the other thing, like they don't necessarily take to you. So Zali'd been over there for ages, and we hatched a bit of a plan. I'm not sure if I should talk, well, I don't know if Apollo campers are ever going to listen to this, but we were going to go over it, we were going to take Zali's car over there and drive back, because dingoes are well known for just chewing through everything. But I went to put Zali's car on the train, and that wasn't going to get there in time. And then I sort of Googled trying to get someone to drive Zali's car over, and then I found out about you can like the rental companies can you can just get the car and drive it to where it needs to be. In this case, Western Australia, and there was a six berth camper van that needed to come from Victoria to Western Australia, and leaving exactly the day that I needed it to leave, so that we could get back here in time for I forget what was that I had to be here back for, and so we went over there and picked up this massive camper van, and done 9,000 kilometres of brand new Mercedes camper van with all these plush seats in it, and we picked up two dingoes.
Unreal. And
drove them pretty flat out, to be honest. Oh no, we were sort of stopping a lot because they need to stop a lot.
Yeah.
It was a whole thing. There wasn't you know, much sleep. We were too terrified. Wow. They were taking a turn to make sure that they didn't eat the cushions. We were trying to hide all these cushions from them. And hiding things from dingoes is pretty hard. Anyway.
Especially if they're not supposed to do them. They're the things that they always find first.
Luckily, or maybe unluckily for them, but luckily for us, they were both reasonably car sick the whole way. So they didn't really go into full dingo mode. They mostly just... we're just sort of like lolling around going, why are we still in here? Anyway, so we drove them across and then put them into the pen that I'd established. Yeah.
And when people come here and get your talks there, Zali, you go through a bit of how the enclosure works without being cruel to them.
Yeah. That
there are, with your knowledge, there are ways that, and obviously trust between you.
Mm.
Yeah, but I'll leave people to hear about that when they come here and hear it from you, or watch your ongoing videos or whatever you end up producing. Yeah, so you're managing all that, and you've got this research arm coming on to really look into more specifically and rigorously what really David's been observing here since he's not killed them off, but tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I did my research in my undergrad, majoring in sort of like ecology, and knew that I wanted to pursue the path of looking at what dingoes do in the landscape. And there's not that much research done on, or actual published papers on dingoes We call it trophic cascades, so how they affect the whole ecosystem down to vegetation level. There's not much research done all the way to vegetation level of what impact dingoes have. There's quite a lot emerging about how dingoes control foxes and cats and might control herbivores as well, but getting the whole web there is quite hard to document. So then it's been fantastic that I've come here and met David and Francis, and they have been observing, you know, since dingoes have come back into this area, the landscape scale changes that they've been observing. So one of the most obvious things that David had noted was that along the rivers there's these really old gum trees, and there's some really young gum trees that are now popping up as well, but there's sort of an age gap in the gum trees along the river, and it sort of seems to be that the age gap in the trees is due to the time when feral goats were sort of
prolific
in this region. Yeah. And so when feral goats were prolific in the region, they would, you know, eat the seedlings before those trees could come up. But now that there's no feral goats left, these trees can actually grow up to be a tree. And then I'm going to try and make that link to dingoes and say, because dingoes control the feral goats in this region, you have these whole landscape effects that occur.
Yeah. And in this way, you were saying that as far as you're aware, you're the only place that will have such a dingo education opportunity for people in Western Australia, and a pretty rare thing in the country as a whole. And this research is pretty cutting edge too, eh? Like,
this
could really change things if you can, I guess, bring some of that sort of knowledge to match the observational
knowledge. Yeah, absolutely. It seems a bit ambitious to try and link these things to begin with, but also I guess we kind of want it to be akin to the Wolves in Yellowstone National Park, which I say is a bit ambitious. It's
And people know about that, but when you look at what's happening, what has happened here, in my opinion, compared to what happened to wolves in Yellowstone, it's so much clearer here, the evidence for the beneficial effects of having that apex predator, because there is simply no new gum trees for 130 years. There's like not a single new gum tree for 130 years. And as soon as the goats got wiped out, there's heaps of gum trees. So if we can age them and then line that up with dingoes coming back and the goats, you know, all being eaten essentially. And that's the other thing, like the wolves in Yellowstone, there's still heaps of deer there. Like it's the deer that were eating the aspen, I think it was. There's still heaps of deer there, whereas we have no goats anymore, like not one sort of thing. So like there's this really clear, whether we can show that or whether Zoe can show that, or I'm helping, whether we can, you know, show that very in a very rigorous scientific way is kind of another thing. But if we can, like I feel like, you know, what's happened here is much clearer and over a larger area than what has happened in Yellowstone. So I see no reason why, you know, Willeen couldn't become the new sort of wolves in Yellowstone. Anyway, that's my dream.
Well, we've just been talking about the new cafe reception area coming from nowhere on the back of a vision. So let it fly. It does make me think too, that hearing about the deer there, it makes me think maybe they're more akin to like the ruse. That there's still ruse around here.
Yeah, sure.
But they're just in a proportion that works in an ecological sense.
Yeah, back in sort of the proportion that they used to be in.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be great to extend the research and document, you know, the landscape changes down to grass level even, you know, because kangaroos and grass is sort of the link that you would make there. But I guess the issue here is those grasses aren't here anymore. So there is for the seeds to be there, the seeds would have to be there for the grasses to then pop up, for the kangaroos not to just overgraze them all out, including the goats and the sheep and, you know, all the other grazing mounds that we hear. So it's really hard in this region to document these other, you know, vegetation species because they're just not coming back yet. So that's why things like the grass nurseries are so important, and maybe over time those grasses will be able to survive into the future because of the dingoes controlling the kangaroos and keeping the goats out. But
there's a grass nursery out behind us here at the moment at the front of our house. We got rid of the front lawn, and now it's a native grass is just going crazy.
Yeah, looks beautiful. We're
collecting seed off that.
Oh, really?
Yesterday.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, I'm wondering, Dave, that what we talked about last time in the Southern Rangelands Revitalisation Pilot Program, firstly, how's that going? What's happened in a year?
So they sort of identified, I think it was 16 stations that were that were eligible for getting some funding. To be honest, it's kind of gone the way a lot of government funding goes. You know, there's been more sort of training available, I guess, for the proponents, and less people, you know, available to receive that money. But I think in the end there was only sort of 10 stations that got the money. But it wasn't anywhere near enough to implement systems, which is what, you know, I really hoped that it would implement and test, like, whole systems, even if they're just, you know, Joe Blog's system for doing it. Because I feel like that's what we really need. We need to be able to test and document and fund, like, a whole system to say, you know, if we went to the nth degree with this system, how quickly would that work, sort of thing. Because that's really what we need to know. But with the funding, they've picked little projects out, so it's sort of become like a funding round for I forget what the environmental grants process is called these days, but so they're just sort of funding little projects, which is going to be, you know, it appears we're successful in something that we're going to do, so that's great. You know, we're going to get some money to do a project that we were going to do anyway, but this will obviously speed along. But it's not really going to provide answers. Do you know what I mean? Maybe it will eventually provide some small, you know, piece of the puzzle. But I was hoping to develop, you know, puzzles that were completed and show that process. So in that way, I think it's been a little bit disappointing, but probably not surprising. Yeah. But at the other end of the scale, you know, we're likely to receive some money for implementing rotational grazing, you know, on Wollin, centralising a water point. So that's good. I mean, I think it's similar to what I wrote in my book. I mean, they give out just enough money to make it appear like they're doing something.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is probably not much different in that regard. And maybe, to be honest, I feel like, and I guess I felt like it before, that I was hoping this would be a bit different. You know, I think it's not, government's not going to take the lead.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like for a long time, I thought that only they could because of the scale of the problem. And I don't really feel like that anymore because for two reasons. One, dingoes. Like, you know, the dingoes are here despite our best efforts to keep them out of this area. They are here. I reckon they're here to stay. The more we can, you know, push their barrow and change that culture, you know, the more likely we are to come to accept them. So they'll do a lot of the landscape fixing for us. And things like, you know, carbon trading, there's some legislative changes which are still supposedly going through. So, you know, if we can get those up and running, then they might be some of the more long-term solutions. So, you know, I'm pretty positive about the future of this area in an environmental sense. But yeah, I guess it's always, and having said, like legislative changes are the government's gambit. So, you know, that's, it's not like they're not doing anything, but the funding round is certainly not going to get the outcomes that I was hoping for.
Yeah, yeah. Hearing you speak, it does reinforce the conclusions you've come to. I think that in terms of, in a sense, systemic understanding doesn't grow on trees in our culture. So the fact that you can harness some of what funding you'll be able to access because you're going to house that in a systemic approach is great, but that systemic approach isn't coming from where the money's coming from, and that is another leap. It's why culture has such power, it doesn't turn on a dime. And so, yeah, I hear you when you...
It does turn, though.
It does turn, 100%. Yeah. Yeah,
can't really avoid it.
Yeah.
Can put it off for a long time. I don't think that that's what's happening, though. I think the culture is definitely changing. Yeah, in lots of different ways. And pastoralism, and a lot of that's just been driven from pastors not being able to make a buck for such a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if they still were making money all the way through, then they'd be like, we're right, you know, nothing's wrong. But, you know, they can't. They can't really say that when everybody's struggling.
That's true of producers all over the country of every kind. And Zali, this is actually part of what really, I guess, inspires me about your presence here as well. It's as much because, again, you're another, and I'm seeing this widespread, right, another presence of next generations, if you like, with a passion for being out here.
Yeah.
In this otherwise sort of cultural narrative we've been in, we're still in it. Like, this is such a strong narrative that young Australians don't want a bar of places like this.
Yeah.
But I'm seeing young Australians in different places in different ways, like you, absolutely not abiding by that narrative. Young people with options finding a passion in places like this. So it's interesting observing that here as well. And I've just been from another place down south that was another case in point. I'm seeing it widespread. It's like, it's like there's another aspect of culture changing that's sort of, it's still under the surface, under that narrative of bloody lazy Australians, they don't want to work out here and we need migrants to do this and whatever. But no, that there is this next generation. Are you aware of that sort of broader narrative that you're flying in the face of, and is part of your, I don't know, aspiration to show how rich it is?
Yeah, I suppose so. I personally just couldn't imagine being anywhere else at the moment. I definitely wouldn't want to go back to Melbourne. You know, even if I wasn't at Wooleen, I would be doing hopefully a conservation work or still aiming for the ecologist role somewhere else that's remote as well. So I guess it just called to me anyway.
Yeah. And I'm wondering as well, for you being out here in a place like this and with the passion you have for it, is there even a daily practice of sort that you engage in that keeps you, or that grows your connection to a place like this? Or is it indeed through your connection with the dingoes that that happens?
Yeah, I'd say it's even separate to the connection with the dingoes.
Really?
Like, I think there's just something about walking around out here and just breathing in the air and knowing how far away the neighbours are, and, you know, and the things just feel, how do I describe it? Things feel like you can strip right back to what's really important when you're out in the bush. And I think personally, I could go on to a whole nother avenue here and talk about, like, personally, I didn't grow up in a religious household, and I never really learnt much about, you know, even choosing a religion or what religion I'd go by. And for me, it's always kind of just been that nature makes sense. Like, if you're sitting in a landscape, you know, where you don't have all these like resources right there in front of you, like running water and things, things just really are stripped back to what's really important. You know, it doesn't matter what's going on in someone's life, like, nature will just move on, and these things are so much bigger than anything that we could possibly be worrying about. And I think being in a place like this, and even farming and pastoralism in general, really strips back to that of, if we need food, how are we going to get it? If we're going to survive, how do we do that in the land? But also just in terms of your mental being and you know, and the wealth of your life, if you can't get everything you need from being out bush, what are you really, you know, where else are you getting it from, or how else, you know, do you receive that? So for me, I think it's just, you know, even if you are in a city or in a suburban area, I think if you can't look at what's really important in what's around you, going back to the environment and, you know, the bare basics, I think that's just not a world that I want to live in, I suppose, to be completely disconnected from that. And I think that goes on to another topic as well, about in our suburban environments and in cities, there is lots of work to be done in the conservation field as well. And there is plenty of life and things happening around you that you know, that is really, really important, but also worth noticing as well that a lot of people don't notice. And I think it doesn't matter where you are, you can always revert back to that. But for me, being out here is really where I get my feel, I suppose.
You know, it reminds me too, Dave, of, again, what I see a lot around places like this who are regenerating the landscape and the opportunity for different enterprises, if you will, to run, like what Zali's doing, like livelihood to be gained just by being here and doing it.
Yeah, and that's a big part of this new building. You know, it's about providing a space where other people can come and, you know, do their thing with us. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, to help each other sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the Maloon Institute really comes to mind when you say that. Like, you know, how good they are. When I went and visited, which was a while ago, but I'm sure it's the same. You know, how many, you know, different people they had, all this diversity. And you get, it also gets back to the systems. Because it's like, if you've just got the couple on the station, you know, it's like, oh, you know, what about this thing? And it's a great idea, but you're like, we're already run off our feet. Yeah. You know, we don't have time and or even energy to do that thing that we actually want to do, but we just don't have time. And so, you know, I guess we've sort of broken out of the mold 15 years ago, really, or 16 now. And, you know, and you would see this all the time and you hear about it all the time, regenerative agriculture, you know, the further you break out of that mold and the more you sort of open it up to different things, there's so many avenues to do different things, and there is more time and there is more support in terms of passionate people coming to wanting to help you. I mean, just having said that, like, I think about going through COVID, like, you know, all of us, you know, normally we got sort of backpackers for staff, and then, but because, you know, our brand is sort of out there, some people know we do, or if they're applying for a job and they've got, you know, five to choose from, and one of them, you know, has got, you know, our backstory and they sort of read into it, they're like, oh, that sounds good. And, and it just continues to build. And I feel like the more sort of conventional you go, if we're going to use that as as the opposite to sort of regenerative sort of movement, the more it just sort of closes down, it just sort of ratchets in. But the more you look at the other way, the more it sort of snowballs and gets bigger, and there's just all these opportunities sort of come out, you know, all over the place. And all of a sudden, you know, we're supporting Zali's research, which is just incredible. We've moved this fabulous building, which people are going to love. That means that we need to employ people to run the cafe there. All of a sudden, we're building a community again. And it's like, how did that happen? Like, it was just me and Francis at the beginning, just slogging it out, going, we've no idea how we're going to pay the bills, sort of thing. We've got fantastic staff. We've got a really amazing cook, you know, and they all share in our, you know, that they have very similar sort of values, I guess. And it really feels like we're building something which has the strength and the diversity to continue to build itself. Do you know what I mean? It's like in the beginning, I have to do all of this stuff. Yeah. And all of a sudden it's like, not all of a sudden, it was 16 years, but, you know, it feels like now it's like, you know, there's this thing that I should do, but I'm not going to worry about it that much. You know, I'll put my attention to it when it comes up because I've got other places to put my attention. And it just creates itself. Mm. And it, yeah, I don't know, it's definitely the way to go.
Hands down, it's a great way to describe it. And you imagine that playing out across certainly the Australian landmass.
Yeah.
But of course beyond as well, but that's possible.
And I feel like that's probably a big thing that does inhibit young people coming back, especially to a place like this. I mean, our nearest neighbours are 35 kilometres away, and the nearest pub's 200 kilometres away. But, you know, there are a bunch of, you know, young people working here, all with pretty similar values. It's always been a beautiful place. So you've got that. There's more staff coming, and we will employ people with a similar thing. And all of a sudden, like, it is a lot more attractive because there's you know, we're not just a really, you know, incredibly small, well, it's not really a community, just a couple.
Yes.
You know, I'm going to work for this couple in the outback rather than I'm going to go work on,
you know. Be part of something.
Yeah. You know, a small community.
I really love how you said the encroaching feeling, because I think that's where that other narrative I was talking about comes from, where no one wants to go out and work anymore. Like, because they don't want to work in that sort of a feeling. I know there are complex layers to it, but I think that's a big part of why these two narratives are in parallel. Like, how do they reconcile? I think that's how they reconcile. There's another trajectory that is, it's a self-generating, self-replicating thing that is just one big invitation to join in, and in multiple ways. I mean, just even walking around and seeing extraordinary change in nearly 3 years since we were here last time. With the grasses coming up.
Debated. It can't possibly be that long, but anyway. It
doesn't feel that long, does it? But beautiful to watch. And then, to see the community coming up too, which we sensed that last time as well. It's just coming on even more in your presence, Sally, is absolutely part of that.
I suppose that's such a common thing, especially with backpackers coming and going, that working out on stations is usually seasonal work, or, you know, you're working for a short amount of time, whether that's as a mustering crew or bits and bobs. But I think to be able to have, you know, you guys are very accommodating of me wanting to do my research, and you're really inviting me on to be a part of it. It's been incredible to feel like, this isn't just like a, you know, a 5 month thing or a, you know, 2 week thing. Even some people just work for really short stints. It is actually, you know, like, as you said, you've got these big things that you're working towards. For me to feel like I could be a part of that even, or to have that idea that I could have a bigger place here, is pretty an amazing feeling too, that you guys have been great at creating. Yeah,
beautiful. So Dave, I'm wondering then, the changes that we talked about in you about a year ago as well, and you joked at the end, something like, you hope you won't relapse from your immersion. The changes you're really enacting at the time, and you clearly haven't, you've gone on with it. Is this what feeds that, or is there indeed some other, even, daily practice that you tap to maintain the perspective you want to maintain?
I think the pressure sort of builds up to sort of break the mold in myself, you know. Also, you know, in terms of, you know, managing landscapes and sort of changing culture and that sort of stuff, but also within myself. And while I was trying to break the mold for the culture, certainly I hadn't been doing much in terms of breaking the mold within myself. And I was pretty, I don't know what the word is, but like I did find it quite difficult to break down my own construct of what was necessary in order to make Wooleen function. And a lot of that was pretty, it was about excluding other people so that they didn't have a negative effect. But that also excluded a lot of people that could have had a really positive effect. So you know, I feel like that was sort of building up for a long time. But I also think, you know, this I was talking about the snowballing positive changes, you know, that's the sort of thing that breaks through that pressure. And it's like, oh, hang on a second, like all these things that I've been holding on to that I've thought are necessary in order to, you know, make sure that people do the right thing, in inverted commas, in the landscape, or, you know, do these things so that we save enough money so that we can survive financially. Like, it's just been really nice sort of breaking those open and going, well, hang on a second, like, yes, you know, maybe we can do this with three people, but, you know, four people might mean that we can employ five people, and then all of a sudden, like, that's, you know, that's going to be really helpful. And I think that Francis has probably always had a much better understanding of that than I have. Just sort of getting to that point where I can sort of let go a bit, let go of a lot of the control, really. but in ways, letting go of, I feel like the letting go of control gives you back control.
Mm.
Because it feels like I was so obsessed with having control that I didn't really, I wasn't getting the outcomes I actually wanted. So, or that I was aiming for, you know, it was my sort of control that was holding me back from an understanding more than control, an understanding that I didn't need control, maybe. Anyway, so in terms of like sort of daily stuff, like I've taken up yoga. I don't know if I said that. Like, I mean, I haven't been doing that much later. It's more like once a week. But I was doing yoga every day. That's been amazing. You know, going for a run, you know, every other day. Well, I feel like those are bigger things, but a whole bunch of just little things, like, well, it's probably not a little thing either, but just thinking more positively and pulling myself up when I feel negative about anything, really.
So you just stop that train.
Yeah, yeah.
Set it in the other direction.
And it's just so much more enjoyable.
When I was listening to you speak before, I'm just hearing the parallels with the dingo story, you know, the apparent paradox in pushing so hard for control
of this species. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. How interesting.
Yeah.
Laws of nature, you might say. I mean, that they play out through us as much as...
And that's it. The dingoes give you control. They give you control of your landscape.
If you can let go of
them. Yeah. And it's a bit like, we talk about, because the goats and kangaroos were presenting so much of the grazing pressure, there was no point in them developing grazing systems that fit in this country, which this is essentially some form of rotational grazing, be that, you know, very intensive or not. But, you know, the landscape does need, in my opinion, to be rotationally grazed if you're going to have, you know, control of fixing areas that are degraded.
Yep.
But you never had that control because the goats and kangaroos were unmanageable, so they would just get into, so, you know, say you wanted to fix, you know, this paddock that was, you know, in trouble, you could never keep the grazers out. So you could never fix it. So then you think, well, why bother keeping the sheep or cattle out? It's not, the goats and kangaroos are going to eat it anyway. We might as well at least make a bit of money out of it. So it never got fixed.
That is classic systemic insight there too. It's like through one portal, it all virtuous cycle one way, but through the other, you can't make it work piecemeal. Like, one thing won't do it. It's classic sort of portrayal of that right there. Because one thing won't do it, it's the devil, you know, and on we go type of thing, which we see plenty of too, of course.
Yeah.
How interesting.
And I've said to people, like, you know, we need to do rotational grazing. I've said to farmers, I said, we need to do rotational grazing. And they're like, yeah, like, that's of course you do. You're like, that's a given. I'm like, yeah, but the thing is not a given is that you need dingoes in order to do rotational grazing. And you sort of see them sit back again and go, yes, that is a problem.
Oh, it's cracking insight though, isn't it? It's got the whole package has to come at once. And this is true for any domain, really. This is what we see. And certainly in this domain, it's sort of right in front of you.
Yeah, but it's so hard to break out of that. I mean, we're calling it culture, but it's not really that. It's more like it's brain wiring. You know, it's hard to get out, because you can, when you're in that hardwired, this is the only way it can work. You're like, well, you know, but you need this thing. And they're like, well, you can't have that thing because of this thing. Yeah.
That's true.
And it's like, but if you had this thing, and then they just get overloaded. They're like, well, I need a billion different things in order to make that first thing happen. And they're like, exactly. That's what you need. Yeah. You essentially just need to start again. Like, you know, with all your knowledge of how to actually run the property, but just like get rid of all of the. Yeah.
Or anything. Again, any domain at all. But yeah, including a property. No, that's exactly it. It's the seeming paradox of letting go and control, but giving yourself over to what actually works ultimately. Zali, last word to you.
Yeah.
Because we end every episode talking about a piece of music that you might be listening to now, or that has been significant in your life.
Yeah. I should have known this was coming.
Something we played in the motor.
I'm thinking about the song I Wonder by Ella Grace, but that's not, I don't think that's the song that I necessarily want to choose. I've been thinking about like the Woolleen playlist from last year that, like, I don't know.
Oh, yes.
Lots of Cat Stevens and even like Tom's Diner. They're like classic Wooleen songs for me. The staff that worked here last year would say the same. Like, they'd hear these songs straight away and go, yeah, that's Wooleen.
Beautiful. Is there a dingo anthem?
Oh, Dingo by John Williamson.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
That's a good one. We should say that one, actually. They actually talk in that song, well, John Williamson talks in that song about dingoes doing their job in the landscape, about them controlling the kangaroos and the sheep and the
rodents. When did he do this?
Yeah, this is early 80s. I remember we listened to that in the car, and the family, we love John Williams, you know, all the words. And then the dingo song would come and everybody just sort of sit there awkwardly. It's like, why is he making out dingoes to be good? Like, what's going on? He's talking about stopping the kangaroos from eating it all away and stopping the rats from eating it all away. And like, John Winston, I think you've missed the mark on this one, but he was spot on. Like,
wow.
You know, shout out to John Williamson.
100%. You know, yes, she busked in Derby at the markets there, singing Papa Whiskey November by John Williamson a couple of years ago. Yeah. Made $50 in 5 minutes.
Nice.
This is his next tune, I reckon. I'm going to suggest it.
Yeah.
Thanks, you guys. This was unreal to sit around the table here, and the dog's back for a chuck of the stick, so get its wishes. Thanks a lot for speaking
with
me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you once again.
That was David Pollock and Zali Jastrzemski at Wooleen Station a couple of weeks ago. For more on Dave and Zali, Wooleen Station and the dingo tours there, see the links in the show notes. This episode is dedicated to Frances and her nan. Frances was overreached for her nan's funeral while we were at Wooleen. I actually featured a very early episode with Frances amongst my summer flashback releases earlier this year, so if you'd like to hear more from her too, tune in to episode 149, or the full version, way back in episode 9. And incidentally, as we left Wooleen Station and headed north towards Ningaloo, I don't think we'd ever seen as many wild goats, or cats for that matter. It put some kind of exclamation mark on this conversation. And, for that matter, on the next big regenerative agriculture event in Australia, that'll be in Margaret River, WA, in September. I'll be MC amongst some stellar company, and hope to see some of you there. The link for that is in the show notes too. For subscribers, I'll continue to send you behind-the-scenes snippets and advance news of what's unfolding as I get around the country, and if you've been thinking about becoming a subscriber, I'd love you to join us. It's with thanks, as always, to this community of generous supporters that this episode was made possible. Just head to the website via the show notes, regeneration.com/support, and thanks again. Thanks also for sharing this episode if you can think of someone who might enjoy it. My name's Anthony James. Thanks for listening.